This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins. The horror of school shootings have become all too common in recent years, but last week's in Parkland, Florida, appears to have struck a different cultural and political nerve. We look into why this time could be different. But first, today's breaking news, the death of Billy Graham. The Charlotte native died at age 99 at 7:46 this morning at his home in Montreat near Asheville, North Carolina. For six decades, Graham preached Christian gospel to 215 million people all over the world. He also influenced social movements and politics in America and beyond. WFAE's Mark Rumsey has this profile of Billy Graham's life and ministry.
Generations of people around the world could instantly identify this voice.
I'm going to ask you to trust him tonight. I'm going to ask you to take that first baby step and say tonight, I need Christ, I need God.
I want to receive. That was Billy Graham in Chicago, 1962. William Franklin Graham Jr. was born on November 7, 1918, 4 days before the end of World War I on the family's dairy farm along Park Road near Charlotte. Billy Frank, as he was known in boyhood, milked cows, played pranks, and soaked up his parents' strict Protestant values. Graham biographer William Martin says the young Billy also got early glimpses into the lives of traveling evangelists who often stayed in the Graham home.
Billy, as a boy, had a chance to sit at the feet, literally, and to listen to these evangelists tell stories of what they were up to. And that thrilled him.
Although immersed in religion early in life, Billy Graham later wrote that as a boy he was spiritually dead. That is, until around his 16th birthday, when evangelist Mordecai Ham came to Charlotte. Graham responded to the preacher's gospel invitation in what Graham would recall as the moment in which he made his real commitment to Jesus Christ. After high school and a summer selling Fuller brushes, Graham was off to college. He began at the staunchly conservative Bob Jones College, but Graham soon enrolled at Florida Bible Institute near Tampa, where he also got fundamentalist training, but in a less rigid environment. He again rubbed shoulders with visiting evangelists, and says William Martin, Graham began to hone his own preaching skills in the swamps of Central Florida.
While he was there, he would practice his sermons. He'd go out and preach to alligators and birds, and go into the school bus barn and preach to the buses. One of the officials at the school there said Billy wanted to do something big. He didn't know just what it was, but he wanted to do something big.
After graduating from the Bible Institute, Graham enrolled at Wheaton College near Chicago, where he majored in anthropology. He fell in love with Ruth Bell, the daughter of missionary parents, and the couple married in 1943. Billy and Ruth Graham had 5 children, and the marriage endured until Ruth's death in 2007. Graham's vocation continued to take shape through the 1940s. He pastored an Illinois church and served as a college and seminary president at Northwestern schools in Minnesota. Graham also helped launch Youth for Christ International, and he began to receive more invitations to preach.
I'm glad to tell you tonight that Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has an answer to every problem that you face. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, has an answer to every burden that you carry.
That's Graham in Los Angeles during a 1949 crusade held in a circus tent. The meetings stretched from the scheduled 3 weeks to 8. The surrounding publicity placed Graham on the national stage for good.
This is the hour of decision with Billy Graham.
Then sings my soul, my Savior.
Graham's new radio program was launched in 1950 and was soon carried by hundreds of stations nationwide. The same year, the Billy Graham Evangelistic Association was formed in Minneapolis. Graham wasn't the first evangelist to tap the power of radio and then television, but he was a pioneer in taking the gospel to the masses through media, from films to broadcasts of recorded crusades shown in prime time on network TV. In 1954, Graham was featured on the cover of Time magazine and held his first overseas crusade in London. Graham later became the first major evangelist to penetrate communism's Iron Curtain to address audiences throughout Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. The Graham evangelistic machine quickly became very well-oiled, But longtime associate and Graham's brother-in-law, Leighton Ford, says there was more than organization at work.
It was a move, a surprising move, spiritual move, that somehow met the mood of the day and the needs of people. And this young man who came across the scene with this very straight, simple, powerful message.
Graham's core message about sin, repentance, and salvation never changed. But over the years, his preaching style and his theological worldview evolved to become more encompassing. Graham biographer and Duke University professor Grant Wacker.
There is the legacy of Graham's insistence that the gospel is broader than any one tradition, certainly broader than his own Southern Baptist tradition would have dictated. And that the task of the Christian evangelist is to proclaim God's love and to leave the judgment to God.
Graham's view of the gospel also grew beyond the lines of the segregated South in which he grew up. During a Tennessee crusade in 1953, Graham personally removed the ropes that local organizers intended would separate blacks and whites in the audience. And he consistently preached that Christianity knows no ethnic or racial boundaries.
Don't ever say it's a white man's religion or a black man's religion. It's a world religion. He belongs to the world.
Billy Graham became a fixture in American life, including the realm of politics. He met with every U.S. president during the course of his own public life and developed personal friendships with several. The associations at times left Graham vulnerable to criticism. Again, Duke professor Grant Wacker.
Graham lent his extraordinarily personal prestige to the presidents. And herein, I think that he was naive. He simply did not realize that his presence had the effect of legitimating a president or a presidential policy.
Graham's close ties to President Richard Nixon proved especially awkward. When the worst of the Watergate scandal became public, the president's loyal friend would later write, Graham found the details almost unbearable. Politics aside, Billy Graham offered hope to the nation in the midst of its worst traumas. In 2001, he spoke at a memorial service held in Washington's National Cathedral 3 days after the September 11 terrorist attacks.
Yes, our nation has been attacked. Buildings destroyed, lives lost. But now we have a choice, whether to implode and disintegrate emotionally and spiritually as a people and a nation, or whether we choose to become stronger through all of this struggle to rebuild on a solid foundation.
In 2007, three former presidents and a host of longtime associates and friends gathered in Charlotte to dedicate the Billy Graham Library. Former President George H.W. Bush delivered an emotional tribute.
And so we're gathered here today because Billy Graham, the man, the preacher, the humble farmer's son who helped change the world, is a spiritual gift to all of us.
And as similar accolades piled up, Graham's wry humor surfaced.
I feel like I've been attending my own funeral.
Billy Graham, admired by millions, seemed ever quick to deflect personal praise, as during this 1996 news conference prior to his final hometown crusade in Charlotte.
I'm not that good. I'm not a great preacher. I'm just an ordinary proclaimer of the gospel. I would call myself an exhorter, and I have one message, and that is for people to be sure that they're right with God, and that they're ready to go to heaven when they die.
One man with a singular message, a message delivered with passion to all who would listen.
Back here on Charlotte Talks, Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins. Again, if you're just joining us, Billy Graham has died this morning, 7:46 a.m. at his home in Montreat in Western North Carolina. Obviously, a Charlotte native who went on to become an international figure, preaching to millions of people. We have with us today Ken Garfield, who is the communications director at Myers Park United Methodist Church here in Charlotte, and the former religion editor at the Charlotte Observer. He is also the author of the book, Billy Graham, A Life in Pictures. Ken Garfield, thanks for joining us. Good morning.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So, Ken, you know, this is obviously such a towering figure that we're talking about. What are some of the initial thoughts that you have had this morning?
Personal sorrow. I got to know him a little bit. I got to know lots of his family members. And, you know, I had maybe 6 to 10 personal encounters with them that I'll never forget. And so there's a personal sorrow, and then there is a, you know, reflecting on sort of his historic, soaring sort of impact.
Yeah, that clip, I don't know if you heard it, where he, in 1996, right before he delivered his final crusade here in Charlotte, he said, "I'm just an ordinary proclaimer of the gospel." You followed his career, you followed the man and the family. He was anything but.
Oh, absolutely. I think there are, you know, a dozen reasons that can fill history books on why he had this impact. He came along post-World War II when America was looking for hope. He harnessed and mastered technology and the spectacle of religion in a way that nobody else has since then. He was a man of personal charisma. He was handsome. And you put all these things together, he surrounded himself with very smart, visionary people. And best of all, or most of all, he touched people in a way that nobody else did. He offered them a sense of hope after World War II and now into the turbulent times we live in now. And he offered them a very simple message of hope through God. And I remember going to the altar calls all over the world, and people would stream out of the stadiums as they played "Just As I Am," because he said, "Come, we'll wait for you, and you can know a peace that you've never known." And I think you put all those things together, and he touched people in a way that nobody since, and perhaps nobody ever will.
And in the course of covering him, I'm wondering whether you got a glimpse of that humility that we heard people mentioning in Mark Rumsey's piece just a few minutes ago.
He was more complex than that. He was a simple farm kid, grew up in Charlotte on a farm. He was that. He was humble in the sense that he was self-deprecating, but he was also humble in a wily sense, in that that was part of his persona. I always kind of theorized that he was much more humble and much simpler and warmer than his people around him allowed him to be. They kind of put up a gate between him and folks in the media and other folks. I think if you sat down with him, you would sense that humility. The two personal memories that I have along those lines is when he was promoting the 96 Crusade in Charlotte. He's very clever, and he would have the Charlotte Observer reporters in specially, and he brought us into his home for lunch with Ruth, and what we had were Big Macs. I remember that. And then I remember I wrote a column for the Observer. I must have been in a sorrowful mood, and I wrote about loneliness and the tenor of the times, and he wrote me a long personal letter talking about loneliness, and that's the biggest problem he sees in life today. And then he mentioned my wife, Sharon, by name. She must be a wonderful woman. And I thought, that's the Billy Graham that I have, that I came to admire as a person and enjoyed covering as a journalist. The Billy Graham on the kind of the one-on-one moments that he was then able to translate into full stadiums. And I think that's part of the magic, too.
Ken Garfield, thank you so much for joining us and offering your reflections on Billy Graham, who is dead at 99. Stay with us. We're going to switch gears to the intersection of guns and politics right here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Back on Charlotte Talks, I'm Eric Spanberg in for Mike Collins, and we are now exactly 1 week past the mass shooting that killed 14 students and 3 adults at a Florida high school. And a familiar debate over gun laws and gun safety is once again taking center stage in American politics. Despite a surge in mass shootings since the Columbine massacre that left 13 dead at a Colorado high school in 1999, little has changed when it comes to gun laws. So this hour, you're going to hear from experts who cover the political side of the gun debate and we're going to ask them about whether this time might be different. We're going to start with Lindsay McPherson, who is a reporter at Roll Call. She is covering the policy debate on guns in Congress. Lindsay, thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me on.
So, Lindsay, let's start with Friday. You wrote, 2 days after the shooting, you wrote about a bill introduced by House Democrats that the authors say might have prevented the attack. What are they proposing?
They're proposing a federal grant program that would incentivize states to create laws that are referred to as gun violence restraining orders. There are a few states that already have these laws, California and Connecticut, for example. And what it basically does is it allows law enforcement or family members of people who are showing signs that they might want to inflict harm to others or themselves, like depression, substance abuse, violence, to petition the court to temporarily take away that person's gun. And so this is only in like a handful of states, 5 or 6 so far. And what these lawmakers want to do is encourage other states to set up similar laws. So they would create a federal grant program that would provide money to the states if they were to set up those laws. But it doesn't actually, the bill itself doesn't actually appropriate the money. The way Congress works is you can create a law authorizing a program, but then there has to be a separate law appropriating the money.
So go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, so it's a one step and in a two-step process, and it so far only has Democratic support, so it's unlikely to go anywhere, to be honest with you.
Okay. You answered my next question. At the same time, House Speaker Paul Ryan last week said, quote, "We need to think less about taking sides and fighting each other politically and just pulling together." And he also said that the House had previously toughened background checks, but to no avail because of inaction in the Senate. What's your sense of the Speaker's willingness to act?
Another, to be honest with you, I don't think he's very interested in the type of gun control laws that a lot of people are pushing for right now. He does refer often to the mental health issue. The law that Congress passed a few years ago was not really directly targeted at people, you know, who commit violent crimes. It was a very expansive mental health law, and it might incidentally impact some of those people, but it wasn't like they set out to write that law for that purpose. They lean on that as a crutch often in their rhetoric to say that, you know, we're targeting mental health. But a lot of people believe that the issue extends beyond that, that there really needs to be some direct laws addressing gun control. And the background check that the speaker referred to, it came after that Texas shooting where the shooter at the, you know, who targeted that church in Texas had a history of domestic violence that was not reported to the background check system. So legally, he should not have been able to purchase guns had the correct information been reported from the military to the background check system. So all that law they did pass. Well, it's not law yet. It only passed the House, not the Senate. All that really does is basically direct federal agencies and states and the military to do this type of reporting to make sure that it, in cases where somebody should not have access to a firearm, that it's actually reported to the background check system so that actually works as intended. So that it's not really a new law per se, as it is meant to enforce what should already be taking place. And so, that hasn't even passed the Senate yet.
We're speaking again to Lindsay McPherson, who's a reporter at Roll Call. What would you say the general reaction in Washington has been this time, and how does it compare to previous mass shootings?
Well, we only had that real, like, 1 or 2 days after the shooting last week where lawmakers actually in Washington to gauge their reaction. They're on recess this week back in their districts. So we'll have a better sense next week as to whether hearing from people back home, you know, you've seen like a lot of these protests. There's more people taking action, particularly high schoolers, in the wake of this shooting, whether that has a new profound impact. But just in the days after the shooting, I was hearing the same rhetoric on Capitol Hill. Most of the bills being proposed or, you know, being talked about were just ones they always raise after these mass shootings and that typically go nowhere. So it just didn't feel that much different to me. The difference I've noticed since then is kind of the president starting to talk about things a little more. And as to whether that has an impact, you know, in the weeks ahead. I guess that remains to be seen, but it's still a tough lift to get Congress on board with passing gun control laws.
And you mentioned some of the protests that have surfaced. It seems the biggest difference so far is that you have students themselves really making political statements. Any idea whether that will make much of a difference with political leaders?
I think it's registered to some degree with the president. I think that's one of the reasons, you know, watching the coverage of that, you know, has had him come and speak out against it. And it might make a difference with some political leaders, but, you know, the cynic in me says that most of those kids are not of voting age, and therefore their voice is limited. But it's a different, you know, call to action, and I think it might have some impact in terms of actually getting a law passed. You know, I think that's still a tough lift. Republicans control the Congress. They're still very beholden to the NRA's position on gun control. The NRA doesn't really support much, except for that background check bill I talked about that passed the House. The president has also endorsed that in case the Senate wants to take it up, which they are talking about. But that's, like I said, a very minor thing that's basically meant to enforce things that should already be happening. A broader background check that bill that Democrats would want, banning like sales at gun shows and online, it would just go a lot further, is unlikely to pass Congress.
Lindsay McPherson, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on.
Again, we're talking about the intersection of guns and politics in the wake of the Florida mass shooting last week. You just heard from Lindsay McPherson, who is a reporter at Roll Call. I'm going to bring on now Robert Spitzer. He's a political science professor and chair of the political science department at the State University of New York at Cortland. He has also written 5 books on gun control and gun rights and the political debate on those issues. He joins me now. Professor Spitzer, nearly every public setting in America, whether it's malls, movie theaters, nightclubs, army bases, schools, churches, has been the scene of a mass shooting over the past 20 years. From a policy and politics standpoint, how did public safety become so non-negotiable in our national politics?
Well, that's a complicated question. I mean, public safety is a chief concern. One of the questions raised by these mass shootings is whether and to what extent government laws and policies or policing procedures can address or anticipate these kinds of terrible events. And it's pretty clear that in a free society, an individual who is bent to doing something terrible can probably do something terrible in some respect. But that gets you back to the question of, well, is there anything that could be done to limit the bad effects of these kinds of things, or to anticipate the possibility of catching people before they do these things? And the news reports often underplay the extent to which prospective mass shooters or people who are planning on doing some kind of terrible violence are caught before the fact. And there have been several items in the news in the last couple of weeks of individuals who indeed were caught before they were able to commit some terrible act. And that's where, for example, the so-called red flag laws come into place. That is, there are 5 states right now that have laws that say that if you, let's say you have a close relative who you believe is disturbed or is engaging in a plan to do harm to people with guns, you can take that to local authorities. They can issue a restraining order to stop that person, to temporarily take away their guns, and to investigate and adjudicate whether there is further action needed. And I mean, that would be an example of a kind of law that is not very common right now, but that could be effective in stopping, thwarting at least some of the terrible mass attacks we've been reading about.
Now, since you're a professor, I'm going to ask you to maybe teach me and some of the listeners a lesson here before we go further into Florida and what's going to happen or not happen after this shooting, because any discussion of guns and gun policy almost inevitably leads to an argument about the Second Amendment and the right to bear arms. The interpretation of that amendment changed about a decade ago in a Supreme Court decision. What did the court do, and how much does that ruling affect our current political debate on this issue?
It was a significant ruling, but its actual impact is not, I think, what many people think. So in 2008, the Supreme Court ruled in the case of District of Columbia versus Heller, for the first time in American history, that the Second Amendment provided a personal right for average citizens to own a handgun for personal self-protection in their homes. And the court was fairly specific about that because that was the nature of the case that was brought before them. 2 years later, in another case, the court applied that principle to the states so that it would apply directly to state actions and state laws. But even in establishing this right, which represented a dramatic departure from how the amendment had been interpreted in the past, that is, as a right tied to citizen service in government militias, but in the 2008 decision, the Supreme Court was also careful to say essentially that, look, most pre-existing gun laws are fine under this rubric, and we are not out to disturb and overturn most of the gun laws that exist today. And indeed, there have been probably upwards of 1,000 legal challenges all across the country to gun laws in the last 10 years or so. And virtually all of those laws have been upheld, including in federal court decisions. So if you think about something like an assault weapons ban, for example, which is probably the most dramatic or extreme kind of public policy or kind of law that is being debated, there are 7 states today that have restrictions or even bans on assault weapons. Those laws, too, have been held constitutional in court challenges. So the Heller decision has not proven an impediment to the enactment of pretty much any of the kinds of gun laws that are being, or proposed gun laws that are being debated now in the national news and in state legislatures.
So you hear some people saying that the shift, and I'm not sure whether 08 is the demarcation or if it's earlier, but the shift from thinking of the amendment as a measure that applies to militias rather than just your everyday person, that is what has, I guess, created hurdles for those who favor stricter gun regulation. Is that interpretation correct?
Well, not really. I mean, it has certainly prompted many more lawsuits, and that a lawsuit can freeze action until the suit is resolved, and lawsuits can go on for months or years. So the litigation that has ensued has certainly slowed down the process of interpreting and applying various gun laws. But as interpreted, it has not effectively had this effect of neutralizing or striking down gun laws around the country. There have been a few exceptions. A state, for example, must have some kind of law on the books that allows civilians to obtain handguns, for example, that you cannot bar handguns from civilians, according to the 2008 decision and to a couple of subsequent lower court decisions that came thereafter. But it's more significant as a symbol of gun rights. And there are certainly some Americans who believe that any time a human hand comes in contact with a firearm, that the Second Amendment comes into play. And these Second Amendment rights are often extolled kind of in those rather extreme terms. But that's not what the law says. That's not how the amendment has been interpreted or reinterpreted. It's not how it's been applied to gun laws. So the Second Amendment, not a functional obstacle to the enactment of the kind of gun measures that the country's debating now.
So as we look at Parkland, Florida, and we see the student activism that has emerged after this tragedy, there are national marches and walkouts planned. What difference do you think those circumstances might make?
Well, that's the big political question of the moment. I would note first that this kind of student reaction from the students at the high school in Parkland, Florida, is really unprecedented. In 1999, after the Columbine shooting in Littleton, Colorado, you did not see the high school students at Littleton grab microphones and get camera attention and demand tougher gun laws. You did see some of the parents and family members talking in those terms, but the high school students, by and large, were, you know, leave us alone, respect our privacy. But these students want to seize this movement, and they really have. I mean, it has been quite a remarkable moment, partly because it's not something we've seen before. And I think they've spoken with great eloquence and passion about what they think needs to change, at least in general terms. the big question is, first, the immediate consequence, and second, the long-term consequence, if any. And there are already plans being made to have a nationwide march next month in Washington, D.C. by high school students, and also a 17-minute or a 10-minute student walkout of students around the country to dramatize their support for stronger gun measures. And this is grabbing national attention. I think it is moving the needle some on the gun issue. Now, getting state legislatures and much less the Congress to act meaningfully is a much bigger haul. I would say at the outset that the prospect that this current Congress will move ahead to debate, much less enact, significantly strengthened gun laws is zero. If there were 100 mass shootings next week, I don't think this current Congress would move. They might take action on the background checks issue that President Trump talked about. It's even conceivable that they could move ahead on legislative action to restrict bump stocks if the Justice Department administrative procedure that Trump has proposed does not pass legal muster. It's not entirely clear that bump stocks can be banned just by a decision of the Department of Justice. It might require legislative action by Congress, but we don't yet know if that will occur or if the NRA would agree with that. And that, I think, would be key to any action coming from Congress. Still, the final part to this is, if this student movement and their supporters can bring this issue into the fall 2018 elections, that could be significant and could have a real outcome on 2018 election races.
Just real quickly, we're coming up on a break, but I did want to ask you, you know, conventional wisdom is that politicians respond to public opinion. There's a Washington Post poll this week. 77% of people say Congress is not doing enough on gun safety, and 62% say President Trump is not doing enough. Just in a few seconds, sum up, why is that?
Well, because the link between public opinion and the government is more complicated. Sometimes the government does follow the wishes of the people. Sometimes it follows the course of special interests. Sometimes it ignores public opinion entirely.
Thank you, Robert Spitzer. We'll be back with more from him here on Charlotte Talks as we talk about the intersection of gun safety and politics on Charlotte Talks. Back on Charlotte Talks with Eric Spanberg, I am in for Mike Collins. My guest is Robert Spitzer. He is a political science professor and chair of the political science department at the State University of New York at Cortland. He is also the author on 5 books about gun regulation and politics. And we are discussing that, obviously, in the context of the mass shooting at a Florida high school last week. Professor, when we broke, you were talking a little bit about how sometimes public opinion differs from governance. But I noticed in some of your past writing, you have explored gangster warfare, for example, in the 1920s and 30s, and how that led to restrictions on guns. So there is a history in America of some policy shifts on gun regulation. What's caused the standstill, you think, in more recent decades?
Well, that's a key question. You're quite right that in the 1920s and early 30s, rising gangland violence and public dismay about it led to the first significant national gun control law called the National Firearms Act of 1934. And indeed, in most of our history, we've had lots and lots of gun laws dealing with every imaginable kind of regulation of guns, far more, I think, than people realize. But in the last few decades, we've seen a real kind of polarization of the gun issue that has been sparked by several things. Key to that, of course, has been the very hard, increasingly hard line taken by the gun rights community, led by the National Rifle Association, which has increasingly resisted stronger gun laws, although accepting the idea of a few gun regulations in the past, and they have ever more vested energy into the political process and had a fair amount of success in supporting candidates for office who've won election. Certainly during the George W. Bush presidency, gun rights groups and the NRA had direct access to President Bush. President Bush pretty much adopted in its entirety the political priorities of the NRA, leading to the Bush administration supporting a measure that passed Congress that provided legal immunity to the gun industry from lawsuits, culminating, of course, in the 2008 Heller Supreme Court decision, which was a great victory for the gun rights people. And now the Trump administration and, you know, the NRA has thrown in its lot entirely with President Trump. They contributed $30 million to his campaign. They were the first, you know, sort of major interest group to endorse him for president going back to early to mid 2016. And they poured over around $55 million, some people say $70 million, into the fall campaign, mostly on behalf of Republicans. And they have identified very strongly with the Republican Party, this at a time where the party has moved ever more to the right and where there's a very strong coinciding of the interests of the gun rights community and the Republican Party. And right now, of course, the Republican Party controls both houses of Congress. And so this gives them a very great degree of influence within the ruling political party.
Yeah, I want to ask you a little bit about the NRA. I mean, there's always a lot of discussion and debate about the NRA when one of these shootings occurs. The New York Times today in the story about President Trump supporting the idea of limiting bump stocks and increasing the background checks, also quoted Trump at the NRA convention last year, where he said, quote, "To the NRA, I can proudly say I will never, ever let you down." So when you put those two things next to each other, what do you think ultimately happens with the president and what he may or may not endorse ultimately with gun regulation?
Well, I think President Trump will stick with the NRA. He's talked about two sorts of things in the last few days, restricting bump stocks by asking his Justice Department to see if they can issue a new regulation. And also he's talked about, Trump has, about strengthening background checks. But these are both NRA-approved steps taken by the president. Congress has a piece of legislation before it now to restrict bump stocks. And the difficulty with going to his Department of Justice to ask for a ruling to make them illegal is that it's not clear they have the authority to do it under federal law. In fact, going back to the 1934 gun law I mentioned earlier. So he's sticking with them. And I think Trump has as his highest priority personal loyalty of organizations and individuals, and I think he prizes that personal loyalty highly. I think his tie to the NRA is undiminished, and we've yet to, while he's, you know, demonstrating some desire to want to move on these limited measures, I would be very, very, very surprised if he departed from the NRA script at all in the months to come.
Again, we're speaking with Professor Robert Spitzer from the State University of New York at Cortland, who is an expert and has studied for many years the intersection of gun regulation and American politics. The way that this breaks down and the way that you have described it here today, it seems to be a fairly partisan issue. So I would ask you two questions. Do you agree that it is a left-right Democratic-Republican debate? And then secondly, how did we get here?
Well, it is a partisan issue. I mean, there are many issues that divide the political parties. And frankly, in political science point of view, that's what the parties are supposed to do. If the political parties agreed on every issue, how could voters decide which party to support if they wanted to support any party? So the gun issue is not unique in that regard. However, the divide between the parties on the gun issue has increased. And that is part of the era of kind of hyperpolitics and hyperpolarization that we live in right now. And that's part of the reason why the gun issue is so politicized right in this current era, because many issues are in terms of how they're being treated by the parties, as indeed the parties have moved really farther apart on many issues. And that is one reason why it's been even more difficult for Congress and national government to come to any kind of compromise or agreement on whether it's the gun issue or on many other things. So partisanship is very much at play, and it is very much a symptom of the polarizing era in which we have existed in recent years.
With the NRA specifically, what is their power? Why are they so powerful? And are they as powerful as many of us in the media make them out to be?
Well, they are a very experienced interest group. They've been around for a long time. The NRA was formed way back in 1871, although it really didn't adopt the aggressive and harsh political tactics that we associate with it until the last few decades. And certainly raising money, lobbying, the traditional activities of any interest group are important for what they do. But that's not the key thing that really sets the NRA apart. What sets them apart is the fact that their membership, even though it isn't all that large, perhaps around 4 million, is that those members are highly motivated to do a lot of things in the political realm that most Americans don't. When they are activated by the NRA, when they are, you know, get messages that they need to support a cause, they'll do a lot of things. They'll vote based on the gun issue on a single issue basis. They'll contribute money. They'll write a letter, and that kind of, and they'll attend a meeting. That kind of grassroots mobilization around the country is very powerful with public officials. They show up at meetings and complain and express their points of view, which is a perfectly American and legal thing to do. There's an old axiom in politics that says a small but highly motivated minority can often win the day over a large but fairly apathetic majority. And that's key to understanding what makes the NRA unique. Now, in terms of their influence, they certainly have had many successes, there's no doubt, and they're in the catbird seat right now. But historically and over the years, they've suffered their own share of losses and reversals. And when push comes to shove, one often finds that their bark is worse than their bite, and that politicians who have gone up against them have generally done just fine. Their ability to sort of remake the government in their own image has been wildly overstated. And, you know, imagery counts for a lot in politics. They have this very fierce image of being highly successful. And again, they've had many successes, but it's easy to exaggerate the real impact on politics.
Now, what about at the state level? I'm wondering whether you see, first of all, the same fault lines, and whether you expect any more activity at the state level than we've seen at the federal level, although it seems like it would be hard to have less activity than what's going on in Congress.
Well, that's right. And indeed, after 2013, when President Obama tried to get a new gun control package through Congress but failed, you saw virtually every state of the union pick up the gun issue, with maybe a dozen states enacting tougher laws and another and twice as many states going in the other direction, enacting laws to weaken their existing state laws. So the states have been very active on the gun issue, and I would expect to see a number of states move on the gun issue in the weeks and months to come, especially if the federal government does not act significantly. Even in the state of Florida, which has been a fairly successful testing ground for the NRA to get for many of its legislative efforts, we're seeing now some movement from the student pressure and kind of the general mobilization around the gun issue, and Florida may indeed wind up enacting some stronger gun measures of varying degrees. So I would expect to see some significant action in the states, partly because the states are more homogenous for the most part. You've got a bunch of real conservative states, you've got a group of pretty liberal states, and some states that kind of walk the line between the two.
What political middle ground do you see between gun rights activists and gun control activists? Is there a political compromise that you see that's possible out there?
Well, if you were able to brush aside some of the very harsh polemic and some of the polarizing moments in this debate, there certainly are middle ground proposals and ideas that have a lot of support, and public opinion polls have demonstrated that. Probably the clearest example is the case of uniform background checks for all gun purchases and exchanges. Roughly 90% of all Americans and around 80% of all gun owners support uniform background checks to make sure that people who obtain guns don't have a felony record, aren't considered mentally incompetent, were not discharged dishonorably from the military, and things like that. There are some differing estimates on how many gun sales we're talking about here, but the best studies show around 20 to 25% of gun sales and exchanges occur without any background checks at all. And that would be an obvious fix. It's something that could be done. A few states of the union have tightened their laws in this regard, such as New York State. And here's a clear case where the policy solution is, you know, fairly small bore, but could well be done and would meet the approval of not only most Americans, but most gun owners, too.
The attacker used an AR-15 assault rifle last week at the high school in Florida. In 2004, an assault weapons ban was allowed to expire. There's been much discussion of this in the past week. What difference do you think it would make long term to reinstate that ban?
Well, we do know that assault weapons, which are labeled by the gun community the most popular weapon in America, isn't exactly the most popular weapon in America. Assault weapons constitute around 2% of all of the guns that Americans own. And Americans own a lot of guns, close to 300 million. So having said that, we know that assault weapons increasingly are the favorite weapons of mass shooters. They are often used against police. They are often used by drug gangs and other kinds of gangs. So there are very specific ways in which assault weapons have been the source of specific harm. And there is reason to believe that more could be done to stop or at least limit the use of assault weapons in serious crimes, such as in mass shootings. Some states, I think I mentioned earlier that 7 states have laws that restrict or bar assault weapons, and perhaps even more importantly, that restrict large capacity bullet magazines. New York State, for example, has a law that says you can obtain an assault weapon legally, but the bullet magazine can hold no more than 10 rounds, and the magazine has to be fixed. That is to say, it cannot be ejected from the weapon. And what that means is that once you fired your 10 rounds from an assault weapon that you can obtain legally in New York State, if you want to reload it, you then have to laboriously drop in 10 more rounds. And that would prevent the kind of scenario where individuals utilize, let's say, 30-round magazines and then have those magazines detachable. The shooter at the Florida high school last week used numerous detachable magazines. I don't know, I haven't heard in the news exactly what the capacity of those magazines were, but simply eliminating that as a possibility would, I think, be a significant step forward in terms of stemming the deadliness of mass shootings.
So let's end on this. I'm going to ask you a quick yes-no question as we're running out of time. Mm. A year from now, if you and I speak on this topic, will there be significant changes made to gun policy in the United States?
I think there will be, but I think they will not be significant. I think they'll be fairly minor.
Thank you so much. That is Robert Spitzer. He is a political science professor at the State University of New York at Cortland and the author of 5 books on guns and politics. I also want to thank Lindsay McPherson from Roll Call and Ken Garfield, the former religion editor of the Charlotte Observer, who discussed the big breaking story of the day today, which is that Billy Graham has died at age 99. Thanks so much for joining us today on Charlotte Talks. I'm Eric Spanberg, in for Mike Collins, and he will be back with you later this week.